This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on Syncbook Radio. Today, on episode number 9, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, neuropsychologist and author of the book Synchronicity, Dr. Alan Combs, as well as a trilogue with physicist and author of My Big Toe, Thomas Campbell. This week, we once again delve into the fundamental topic of consciousness and its relationship to reality as we know it. The big question is, why do both synchronicity and focused meditative practice seem to pull human beings toward a grander sense of themselves and the universe? Is our sense of larger purpose and a reality outside reality merely a pointless delusion, as rational materialism contends? Or is there an evolutionary imperative to engage with the collective unconscious through what seem to be irreducible spiritual technologies? Thanks again to my guest this week, and thank you for listening. Why don't we start off talking about your book, Synchronicity, which was published in the mid-1990s.
Oh, it was published. I think the original book was written on papyrus. Let me see. Okay, I've got first edition 1990, which means it was written in the late 80s.
Okay.
But, are we on right now?
Yeah, we're
now?
On. We're recording.
Yeah. Okay, well, a little bit about that. So this book's been out for over 25 years nearly, and it's in about 15 languages at this point, and there's a French publisher reviewing it right now for the possibility of translating it into French. But the significance of the fact it's been out so long is it was the first book that really talked seriously about the idea of the trickster, the role of the trickster, and the mythological side of synchronicity. Well, Carl Jung was very interested in those ideas, and we can talk about that. But none of the trade books, or what you would call books for the general public, were dealing with that dimension of it at all. So this was the first book to really seriously look at the mythological dimension, the topic of synchronicity. And as such, it became a kind of a classic. And that's why it's still around, I guess. Yeah, so it's been out for quite a few years, and every time I forget about it, it comes back again and stays in print, and people call me or are interested. Actually, there's been an increase in interest in synchronicity lately. Since you're running this radio show and stuff, you probably noticed that. I've been interviewed twice for films. Not Hollywood films, but one company produces educational films and sets of films. And, for example, they have a set of films about Hollywood directors. And each show has to do with a different director, John Ford, whoever. And they had one of the shows was on magic, or things that are close to magic. Miraculous cures, psychic healing, and so on. And I was interviewed for that. And then there's another fellow who's really made a whole movie about synchronicity. It's just about to be released, I guess. So this is all stuff that's come along in the last year or so. It really surprises me. So it keeps popping up, and it's up right now, as a matter of fact.
I like to think so, and I get a sense of that, and it's always hard to gauge whether your senses of what's going on is actual reality or not. But as a synchronistic person, I tend to agree with that sentiment, generally speaking.
Yeah. Well, I'm aware of it because I'd totally forgotten about even writing the book for at least 10 or 15 years. And now I think you're about the third person that's wanted to interview me about it, although I haven't interviewed with the other ones.
In my recent conversations about synchronicity with some of my co-hosts and what have you, we've talked about the dynamic of synchronicity where you go through plateaus and then it clusters. And there's correlations with, say, poker variance. That's another concept where, again, you have plateaus in your play or how much money you're bringing in, and then you have pretty volatile moments where there's kind of like stormy times in the plateau. So sync seems to
mirror that. That's really interesting. I didn't know about that, but it makes sense.
Yeah, I like to think so too. So you wrote this book, you co-authored it with Mark Holland, and I guess what led you to want to write it? I mean, you must have experienced synchronicity to some meaningful degree in your life and wanted to, I guess, make that accessible to other people. But what instigated it for you? Was there one moment? Was it a series of moments, all of the above?
Well, yeah, you make a good point. I've been interested in synchronicity for a long time and had been interested for a long time. It's so far back now, I can't even remember the details, but I was always curious about coincidences that were just mind-boggling. And eventually I got interested in Carl Jung and read his book on synchronicity. So I continued to have this interest. And sometime in the mid-80s, I wrote one or two articles about it. So there was a journal in the 80s that Ken Wilber edited called Revision. It's still out there, but he doesn't edit it anymore. But I wrote an article on synchronicity for Revision Journal in the mid-late 80s. And actually, it brought an offer to write a book. Jeremy Tarcher, who published a lot of books on sort of borderline topics, had his own publishing house in L.A. His people contacted me and asked me to write a book about it. And I started, but it really didn't work out. I think I didn't really have a book ready in me at that point. I just had the article. But I spent quite a bit of time on it, and eventually they and I agreed that I wasn't going to write a book. So several years went by when it was in the drawer, and then I made this friend, Mark Holland, who was over in the literature department, and he was very interested in synchronicity from a more literary point of view. He was interested in the figure of the trickster in Greek mythology and other cultural mythologies, American Indians and so on. And so he brought something to the table that I hadn't really thought about, didn't really know anything about. So we decided to work together. So the book is a collaboration. And if you look at the way the synchronicity book is written, you'll see essentially the first half of the book is mine and the second half is his. Although before it was all over with, we were all kind of working both on each topic. But he really is the person who brought a deep knowledge of Carl Jung and the connection between Jung and trickster figures in mythology and cultural stories like Brer Rabbit, for example, or Coyote, and Native American traditions and so on. So the whole second half of the book really kind of explores these sorts of ideas. And that was something really, I think, original. I don't think anybody was really doing that in a readable way, at least. And so we ended up with quite a different book. And by the late 80s, we started looking for a publisher again. I wrote back to Tarcher, and he had a new manager, editor. He told me he liked the book, but he didn't want to publish it. He didn't really like the idea of the science in the first half and the mythological material in the second half. But he said, hey, that's just my idea. Don't worry about it. Here, talk to this guy, John White. Well, it turns out John White was the editor during the 80s and 90s for half the spiritual writers, including Ken Wilber. And he read it and he liked it and got us a publisher. So that was how the book got published, and finally in 1990 got published. But it's been through a bunch of different printings, and every once in a while the publisher will want a new preface. I actually don't like the preface that's on it very much right now in the current edition, but the older prefaces are there. They're just near the end. The one of the original preface, I think, was written by the European systems theorist Irvin Laszlo, quite a famous guy in the world. And I think that's in there somewhere. The current preface, there are lots of used copies of this around, but if you get the new one, it's written by an old friend, Robin Robertson, who's a mathematician. He does a nice job with it, but he tries to treat it as weird math or something. And I don't really like that very well. I don't really agree with that approach, but it's interesting and it's short. The introduction, you don't need to read it. Just get what you want. So that's a little bit of the history of the book.
Well, I'm not sure exactly which direction to go there. There's two ways. So let me just pick one because you just touched on math. And I do want to get into the trickster aspect and the mythological aspect and the Jungian archetypes.
Sure.
And also consciousness. But real quick, maybe we can hit on statistics.
Yeah, I have a whole little section on that. You read it?
I've read it several times, and I've really tried to wrap my head around it. And I'd like maybe a further elucidation if you're willing to go there.
Well, basically, when people want to argue against synchronicity, they say, well, probability is probability. Things will happen. Sometimes they'll seem weird. One of the good examples of this is if you take a room with, I forgot how many people. I don't remember the numbers. You may actually know this, but it was like 50 people. And then you say, well, what's the probability then randomly that two or three of those people have the same birthday? Mm-hmm. It's surprisingly high. So there are statistical coincidences that can be pointed out and often are pointed out, but that's not the kind of thing Carl Jung was talking about. Carl Jung was talking about coincidences that are meaningful in some way. And the classic example is that I'm sure you've read, most people that have read anything about synchronicity probably have seen, and that's the example of with the scarab beetle.
Right, his patient had the dream about the scarab, and then as soon as she finished talking about it, it tapped on the glass, he let it in.
Flew in the window, yeah, and it had a dramatic effect on her, because evidently what was wrong with her is she'd been Newtonized, as I say. That is, she wanted to see the whole world as rational and law-driven, and she was trying to live her life that way, and it was making her crazy. And this incident with the beetle just shocked her into the realization that you don't really have a rational grip on everything that happens. And so it was curative for her. She'd already been to several therapists who'd given up on her. Joseph Campbell had an example that I love, and I think it's even in some ways better. Joseph Campbell was a great, as many people know that are probably listening to this, was a great mythologist during the 80s. His series of interviews with Bill Moyers were so popular on TV, and you can get them. They're not very expensive. They were done at the George Lucas Ranch in California, not far from where I'm at right now, just north of San Francisco ways, because Lucas was interested in mythology when he did the Star Wars. So Joseph Campbell was sitting in his flat on 5th or 6th or 7th or whatever floor it was in downtown New York City, and he was writing about an African culture and particularly the symbolic meaning of the praying mantis there. And while he was writing, this huge praying mantis landed right on his windowsill just a few feet away. Downtown New York City, you don't see a lot of praying mantises there. And it was just stunning, you can open the window and in comes this big praying mantis. It's such a distinct insect. So Jung's idea was that these are the kinds of events that make sense in terms of synchronicity, not just the random draw of who you run into on the street on any given day, just because you might know them beforehand. So to get back to the notion of statistics, my argument in this chapter is that statistics, particularly probabilities, I'm going to get a little bit Newtonized here, very rational, but this is important because that's what probabilities are. Probabilities only make sense in a environment where there's a fixed set of outcomes, where you know what the outcomes are. And then, so it's like if it's a horse race with eight races, what's the eight horses? What's the probability one horse will win that you might pick? So that's the kind of environment probability make sense in. You say, well, there's only one chance in five, maybe. I mean, at least you can make a guess, or one chance in 10. But out the real world's not really like that. I mean, there's this example I mentioned of the Queen of Spain who dreamed that she got up and went down into the throne room and there was a pig there. Pig in the throne room. Well, this was not a usual situation. I don't know how many days out of the year there were pigs in the throne room, but I don't think there were any. And she had no reason to expect a pig in the throne room. So there she goes. She goes down and walks in the throne room. There's a pig. Okay. That's a coincidence that probably qualifies as synchronistic. It probably meant something to her symbolically as well. I don't know. But that's the kind of connection that Carl Jung and his friend Wolfgang Pauli, the physicist, were interested in. So just to finish this topic off, sort of reducto absurdum, suppose you're getting on an airplane and you say, well, what's the chances this plane is going to wreck or disappear? God, I've been reading about all these awful things that happen to planes, and the pilot says, don't worry about it. There's only one chance in 100,000 that this plane will disappear or crash, or one chance in 1,000, maybe. He says, well, there, it turns out there are probably over 1,000 planes in the air at any given time. Does this mean one of them is definitely going to crash? I mean, what could that possibly mean? I thought the plane would either make it to its destination or wouldn't. If it makes it to its destination, the probability is one. And if it crashes, probability is zero. Or you can see the other way around. But these kinds of numbers make no sense out in the real world, because you don't have a fixed pool of events that you can assign probabilities to. So that's my idea about probability. It just don't work when you talk about everyday events in a world that's so complex.
Right. So much qualia and whatnot enters the equation that these aren't equatable things. You can't take meaning and plug it into an equation, that kind of thing. And so what your emphasis on context here, and again, working within a box, I mean, that's what statistics is, and what is the world, except it's a complex web that basically knows no limitations. Its connections are too complex and rich to describe that way.
Exactly. Now, yet a little while ago, you were making reference to gambling and gamblers and, you know, playing poker and so on. And in that kind of a situation, at least in principle, you can make some kind of assessment of probabilities. You know, they're evidently too complex for most people, but they are there. And so that's a little different. And so you might actually get some benefit out of probabilities. But to argue that the queen will, you know, see a pig in the throne room every, you know, 10,000 days or something, just makes no sense. So I don't think probabilities, talking in terms of probabilities in a dismissive way about synchronicity, adds anything useful to the conversation. I think you have to just use common sense.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. And also, I feel like some of these conversations are had outside the context of transpersonal psychology, which is what Jungian psychology is, and the archetype idea is couched in. And
yeah,
it's almost that people just don't even have the language to talk to each other about it. So because there's this extreme event horizon of ignorance, they just say, oh, it's made up or whatever. But there's huge natural history, case studies, etc., and within myth itself, that again communicate these archetypes that are totally disconnected from, you know, they're subjective, but they are disassociated from this, the day-to-day life of these people. They just kind of erupt out of their unconscious for no reason. And that's what's so mysterious about it. And then you see it in myth and you're like, what is up with these parallels? So that whole concept of the trickster and you and Mark Holland trying to find the intersection between those topics, that is what many people in the sync community do nowadays, but also it's not, when you wrote this, not so much. And also yours is a more straightforward exposition where some stuff gets a little nebulous. So anyway, why don't we jump off into that if you want to?
Sure. Well, one of the things I'm reminded of hearing you talk is that a lot of these ideas, I think, came to Carl Jung early on in his career when he was a director of psychiatric services at one of the big hospitals in Switzerland. In fact, Carl Jung was, just as an aside, was better known and more respected than Freud through much of his life. And people don't realize that because textbook writers often put him down as a follower, and it's certainly not a good representation of Carl Jung. But anyway, he was caught by the, as you may know, caught by the similarity of some of the visions or hallucinations, perhaps, of these psychiatric patients with mythological material that they couldn't possibly know anything about. For example, one of his schizophrenic patients, you don't see these people anymore because we give them drugs and it either strains them out or they get goofy, but either way, they don't have these really colorful experiences. He saw a penis. He says a penis hanging from the sun. And whatever way it points, the wind blows. Okay, that's an unusual thing to say. And it wasn't long after that that Jung was, because he was always interested in mythology, he was reading an incident of an traditional Native African mythic tale about that, what makes the wind blow. The sun is a tube hanging down whatever way it points is the way the wind blows. So he started noticing these similarities between the kinds of experiences schizophrenics were having and material from myth and fairy tales. And the deeper he got, the more he found. And of course, eventually, he began looking at medieval material, fairy tales, and dreams, especially of anyone, normal people. And there were so many connections that he started to develop the idea of archetypes and the collective unconscious and all that. There had to be something to tie these ideas together. So this was very strange in the middle of the 20th century or even earlier, because Newtonian physics really dominated the landscape intellectually at that time. So here's this guy talking about a kind of what today we'd call kind of radical holism. And ironically, it's become, this kind of idea of a radical holism has become a significant part of physics today. In fact, was really starting to be even at that time, which is why Carl Jung, I think, befriended people like Wolfgang Pauli, one of the contemporary physicists, and Niels Bohr, who he got to know fairly well. So he was really interested in parallels between quantum physics and the kind of holistic single universe that it created and what's going on in the human psyche. So that's another topic we could go into, but basically he was looking for parallels. The old idea was of the atom was in the nucleus and then surrounded by electrons. It was sort of like a little solar system. But Jung's idea of the collective unconscious is a lot more like the quantum notion of or probability cloud, in which there's a nucleus and then there's a cloud of electrons, but you never know where any of them are till you see them. And then you know where they are. So that's the way archetypes are. you know them when you see them.
Right. And it goes to this idea that the Jungian idea that we go through most of our lives not realizing that they are embedded in us or in the collective unconscious, whatever that is, whether it's a field effect or it's something even more bizarre.
Right.
We don't know.
Right.
But we seem to be conduits for this. And the question is, okay, then how can we piece it together? Can we? And yeah, when we get this kind of entanglement of the archetypes kind of coming through people's lives or through their stories, it can become somewhat indecipherable from an outside perspective. Mm-hmm. So there is this highly personal aspect to it that is so hard to put to paper and to describe to folks. But I think Jung does it better than most. And, for someone that wrote so long ago, I mean, what I find is actually the people I read from 50, 60, 100 years ago are so much clearer in how they write than nowadays. So it's actually not that difficult if people want to jump into it.
Yeah. Well, Jung was a good writer, but he had his style. The Jungian style is to write about three or four things and sort of drift between them. So he's got this little book on synchronicity, and you can read it, but a whole lot of his stuff about synchronicity is scattered through all his other books. And then if you really want to read something that makes more sense about synchronicity, go get, what's her name? There's a lady who was one of his students. It'll come to me, but she spoke very good English and wrote quite a few books, and some of them on synchronicity, and very clear. Von Franz, Louise Marie von Franz, died just a few years ago. So it's really hard to keep track of it. And then, as you point out, there's a very personal nature to a lot of synchronicity, and it can just get crazy. In fact, Wolfgang Pauli had dreams that were enormously complex and often troubled. And he kept a journal of these, and the journal was just rife with puns and references and synchronistic connections. It's very hard to sort it all out. It's a real quagmire. You know, and there was this joke about the Pauli effect, that if he went in a laboratory, the equipment would shut down. I guess you probably know that.
Yeah, so the question becomes, oh, did he have any kind of, like, abilities, quote-unquote? And that's always a fun idea to speculate on, because who knows what he was repressing, and he seemed to really be going through some kind of awakening.
Yes, that's often left out of the story. And, you know, some of the best work about David Peete leaves it out, or about Wolfgang Pauli. I'm thinking my friend David Peete, who wrote a book on synchronicity. Actually, I think David's doing a course on synchronicity this summer.
Actually, I do another show as well called Always Record. This is Pentimental, and we had him, David Peete, on a few episodes back. So, yeah.
There you go. What I wanted to say was that David Peete, for example, doesn't talk about this dimension of Pauli at all, but you can find it. He was a very disturbed guy, and he was in therapy, and he had these absolutely crazy dreams. And I think a good description of his subconscious is a pressure cooker. And so he had all this crazy synchronicity going on, and some of it wasn't all that pleasant, because one of the things about synchronicity that you don't hear about much, but it's perfectly obvious, and that is if you're totally stressed out, and especially if you're holding resentments and anger and stuff, terrible things happen. Lights turn red on you, can't get down the street. You get annoyed by things. The dogs bark across the street. I had a friend whose computer caught on fire. I mean, literally, next office, I was screaming. He was in a bad mood. I mean, her computer was on fire. This was an old PC. You know, this is what I call perverse synchronicity, and you can create plenty of it by simply being troubled in a terrible mood and building up this inner kind of pressure. But so it can actually work against you. Anyway, what were you saying?
Synchronicity, I almost have come around to seeing it as kind of like the fifth force or something. It's almost a force of nature in that it's the impetus that brings forth some kind of archetypal revival. So it's not maybe always the thing, but it seems to always be connected to it. So you see the trickster come up again and again in so many forms. So you have the coyote, you have the rabbit, you have the spider, so on and so forth. And so there's this intimate connection between individuation, like self-realization, and synchronicity. And so there's some kind of intersection there. Again, that goes beyond this mechanized statistic thing. It's like we're leaving out the story.
No, I think you're perfectly right. You know, there are ways to facilitate synchronicity, and they all have something to do with becoming more whole and more in touch with yourself and the world. People that go to meditation retreats typically are showered with synchronicities afterwards for a while. There's something about meditation that triggers synchronicities, especially if you do a lot of it. I think contemplative prayer is a similar kind of process. So, and shamanism, Michael Harner, who's probably the dean of writers about shamanism, at least Western writers, in his first book, The Way of the Shaman, was published ages ago, points out that the incidence of synchronicity is sort of the measure of your progress, that you should expect synchronicities as you do the shamanic work. So, you know, all these various kinds of traditions that bring people in touch with their deeper sides of their own psyche seem to trigger synchronicities. You know, and a number of really authentic yoga masters seem to have a lot of synchronicity too. I heard one talk about this. This was a guy who, Swami Rama, who was an amazing master yogin. And somebody said, well, what about all these synchronicities that go on around you all the time? And he said, it is the cooperation of the providence. So something about being in touch with the greater ambiance that you're living in is what we were talking about before. And there's a real spiritual dimension to that.
And I know we don't want to go too far into it, but I just want to say that, you know, for me personally, like general systems theory does help see the world and see our everything around us as a system. And we're all connected parts to that. And there is this holism and at play. And then the question is, what does that mean for our lives? And so I think this is all part of that unveiling kind of.
Well, that's a good point. You know, some of the first systems theorists pointed out a kind of compatibility with synchronicity, or that synchronicity represented psychologically something related to what we were seeing in the larger universe in terms of systems working together, resonating together. So that's a good observation.
And well, maybe we can start talking a little bit about more about human consciousness and maybe how these things relate, or what your emphasis or area of study on that topic has been lately, because consciousness is kind of a big tent in terms of what people are looking at. So I guess, what's your focus there? Is it still involving synchronicity, or is this a whole new ball of wax for you?
Well, synchronicity is a sort of on the side, but we've already kind of touched on it the way I wanted to think about it, that there are certain states of consciousness that bring one in deep resonance with one's essential nature. And meditation is a perfect example of that. When people meditate, and no matter what kind of meditation they do, some sort of non-traditional meditation, it makes for a more holistic experience, at least during the meditation, for some time afterwards. I'm not a very religious person, but I think contemplative prayer for some people has a very similar function. And of course, real shamanic work is psychological more than anything else. So that was my connection with states of consciousness, is that states of consciousness that bring us into a more holistic, harmonious relationship with the world around us and people around us seem to engender more synchronicity. And this, in some ways, I think, is connected to the larger systems view, but it really hasn't been successfully shown just how that happens. But I think it's an interesting connection. I'm working on the idea right now that I hope I'll be able to write a book about, that suggests a kind of dynamic of sort of holistic dynamic of things self-organizing, coming together at a lot of different levels that would include psychological experiences and consciousness experiences.
Right. I mean, yeah, if you zoom out of, I just brought this up again the other day with somebody, if you zoom out of the human collective enough, I mean, look, we're just dots on respects, you know, we might as well be electrons revolving around a nucleus. And then we'd like to say that, okay, these certain experiences aren't open to us as humans. And I think that because it is kind of a bleed through effect, that it's always going to be this kind of flatland phenomenon where it's not what we'd expect from our 3D experience. So we say, oh, it doesn't exist. And that's just kind of passing the buck and not addressing the actual experience itself.
Well, let me say this. I'm shifting gears a little here, but I think it's worth talking about for a few minutes. I think there's a real sea change going on in the intellectual marketplace of the world right now. I'm seeing books by philosophers and physicists and psychologists and talks and so on that more and more are looking at a larger, more holistic universe and not really bowing to the old Newtonian notions and the old mechanistic ideas about physics and nature anymore. There's a big change going on, and you can't always tell it by hearing some of the traditional people speak, except that they're all getting very defensive these days.
Yeah.
Really defensive. In fact, it's like they're circling the wagons. Oh, yeah, everything is. But, you know, some of the basic ideas, and I don't want to teach a course here, but I'll just say it. Some of the basic ideas in the way physicists and other scientists understood the world from the time of the Newton up till just recently, is that it's made up of little parts and pieces, atoms, for example. And the more you can reduce something into those pieces, the better you can understand it. So we take a brain and we analyze it down into nerve cells, and we analyze those down into neurochemical flows, and then what goes on in the synapses and so on. So it's always this move towards reduction. And there's a fundamental assumption that the basic reality is at the bottom somewhere. It's knowing these parts that are essentially not connected, although they bump into each other. And that worldview is really shifting dramatically to a much more holistic, might I say, field-oriented, because there are fields that connect things. In fact, it's getting more and more difficult in physics to even tell objects as separate from each other, as you know. So there's this big shift, and it's shifting. There's a shift going on in consciousness studies. There's an emerging whole area right now of people interested in collective consciousness, not quite in Jung's sense, but more in the sense of actually just experiencing a kind of collective reality that people experience that meditate together, for example. So being connected to other people, understanding that the fundamental reality is not separateness, but it's togetherness in some ways. And there's a shift in neuroscience and brain science away from looking at the evolution of the human brain as something that went on among with individuals creating tools and so on. Now it's beginning to look like the brain is such a social organ that our evolution to human intelligence and language is really something that could only happen in groups, through groups, and with groups, and that our brains are it's just like my computer here connected to the internet. It wouldn't do much by itself. So it was designed to be connected.
Yeah.
And that's the way brains are looking more. Human brains, in fact, and that's one of the things that seems to be more unique about humans, is this incredible social presence. It's going on in physics. It's going on in philosophy. Going on in psychology, it's going on in consciousness studies. And if you hear some of the old traditional people talk, they just blow it off. But it's harder and harder to do. Every year, the surge goes up a little higher. Of course, I live out near San Francisco, so I'm living in a world where this sort of thing isn't strange at all. When I go to the East Coast, I'm sort of amazed. Right. I feel like I've been in a time machine back to the late 1800s. Do you really believe this billiard ball stuff, where I live, we're all connected, we all meditate and so on. It's just a joke, but there's some truth to it.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And we have this huge conference right down the road every year. We're gearing up for another one in the fall that people that organize it are personal friends, called Non-Dual Science. And 2,000 or 3,000 people will be here, and there'll be physicists, quantum physicists especially, brain scientists, philosophers, and they'll come down and they'll talk about non-dual consciousness and non-dual physics, and it's really a shift away from the old model.
I see it sort of as a move towards what's been termed, say, process science or process physics.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's in the tradition of Whitehead.
In fact, the Whitehead is one of the core people.
Yeah.
There's a physicist right now by the name of Lee
Smolin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He writes wonderfully about this and has been for several years.
He has an ecological evolving cosmology, basically. And I have certain problems with it, but he jumps. He's willing to go places that I'm so impressed by for a conventional physicist, quote unquote. So sure. He's actually standing against, say, the string theory orthodoxy and saying, hey, there's more to this than straight up reductionism and finding these little tiny strings at the Planck length. That's not the answer anymore. And it's clear it's not the answer because science is like just so tied up in knots. That's like the premise of his book, but quite literally where we are is that we're basically just postulating the anthropic principle and throwing our hands up and saying, well, there's no explaining anything. String theory is not leading anywhere. So let's just say everything is possible. And that in that bubble, there's unicorns. In that bubble, there's a god, but we can never get to that bubble anyway. So it's just this insane mosaic of nonsense, in my view.
Well, you have a dark view of all this. If you come to California,
well,
straight out.
I know. I don't want to be too negative, but
the thing for me is not whether Smolin is correct or not. It's that Smolin and a lot of other highly qualified people are asking these kinds of questions.
Right, right. So the discussion can be.
And they still keep their jobs. Of course, most of them are tenured, but these are questions that couldn't be raised even 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and now they're in the air. People are talking about them.
Yeah.
So where it leads, I don't know, but the important thing is that, have you seen Rupert Sheldrake's recent book?
Science Set Free?
Yeah. Ripper's a dear friend of mine. You might try to see if you can get him online sometime. But he lists 10 different ideas that nobody ever questions in science and questions all of them and questions them pretty well, I think.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Most of what he takes to task is totally correct and totally worth discussing, at the very least bringing it up. And there's certain gripes I have. They talk about the speed of light changing, but when they say, oh, the speed of light is, it changes, it never upsets their apple cart. You know, they're never using it to question relativity or anything. They're saying, oh, yeah, okay. But Sheldrick's saying, well, maybe we should use it to question relativity. So there is some nuance to that discussion.
Well, Rupert's a very bright guy. He's not a physicist, but he's very interesting. And it's interesting to see the pushback. You know, he and Deepak Chopra were both censored on the national TED Talk, and we had a big battle over that. And I think they finally put it back, but they just took him off.
Especially the targeting of Sheldrake is absurd. I mean, the morphogenetic field idea and that view of biology is not, it's totally logical. I mean, it has a deep tradition in the biological school, and just because the mechanistic view of DNA came along and got primacy in academia, it doesn't mean this other strain of sort of organicism went away. And that he's just from that. There's always been that kind of idea, but they used, he has the morphogenetic field. Other people use things called creodes. So he's just building off old ideas. There's nothing new here. And even David Bohm's view of quantum physics goes like hand in hand with morphogenetic fields. So there's all kinds of things to suggest that actually this is, if you want a physical basis or according, I mean, Sheldrake calls it non-physical. I don't even care what the difference is. Who am I to say what's physical versus non-physical? You know,
you can't get Rupert to talk about what would be called spiritual stuff like life after death. Mm-hmm. He's actually a pretty traditional guy. He goes to church every Sunday. Very traditional in the way he thinks about things.
Yeah, totally studious. And he's received ire because his dogs that know and so on, they seem ridiculous at a glance. You know, they evoke a very emotional response. It's like psychic dogs. What the hell is that shit? You know, it's like, what is this? And so it doesn't matter if it actually shows statistical significance or is like well controlled and he does cross all his T's and dots all his I's. There's always going to be a headhunter like James Randi.
Well, you know, one of his ideas that we were talking about recently is the city of the personal friend is if he has the money, he would like to offer a reward for the best student work having to do with not necessarily dogs, but basically telepathic kinds of things, you know, anticipating phone calls from friends and stuff. I can't tell you the detail, but it's the sort of thing he's interested in. And his idea, which I think is very clever, is to bypass the whole scientific community with this award given to the best research and, you know, not put it in front of a traditional review panel at all. So I don't know. I don't know where that'll go, but it's interesting. Rupert really strikes me as more of a naturalist than a scientist, even though he's trained in chemistry. He doesn't like doing hard research, especially on organisms. He doesn't even like to kill a plant, and he'll tell you that. And so he got started as an experimental biologist, and he didn't like killing things, so he quit. His early work, professional work, before he got into morphic fields was, he was working at a plant agricultural center in India. So, yeah, I think he's more of a naturalist. His father was a naturalist as well.
Right, and the way he speaks, and you can just grasp that from, his language and his presentation.
But the reason I mention this thing about TED Talks is there is a real pushback going on from the conservative community, if you can call them that, against any of these ideas. And Deepak Chopra was another one that they were pushing back. And Deepak, I used to think he was a real flaky guy, but I've gotten to know him, and I now think he's one of the brightest people around. He's certainly not stupid. I mean, he has a degree in, he's an MD, but his specialty is, I'm trying to remember, it has to do with hormones. I mean, this, you got to be smart to get a degree in this.
Right.
And I don't want to say self-educated, but he doesn't come from a wealthy family. He made his way by doing well and getting good grades and whatever. And he's a very clear thinker.
Yeah, and I've said of him that in a marketplace of ideas, he has his place. And I don't agree with him on everything, but the truth is it's this idea that consciousness creates reality. Hey, that's one of the interpretations of quantum physics. You can't just say, oh, look at this crazy kook. No, there's really actually a whole school of thought around that. That's not Deepak Chopra. That's one of the three leading contenders for interpretation of quantum physics.
Well, there's no doubt that Deepak likes Vedanta.
Yeah.
And it sort of seeps through everywhere. But, you know, but he's a very clear thinker, and he's not gobbledygook. He has a center now that's doing research on meditation and healing and health, and they have some stunning results. I don't know if it's been published yet or not, but real dramatic changes in blood chemistry after just a week of meditation and using different styles. You know, there are several different styles that are fairly common. One is a concentrated meditation like TM, like on a mantra. One is a very common Buddhist meditation. I'm trying to remember what it's called. It's just open. Just observe your thoughts. And the third one that's getting more popular in my neck of the woods is compassion meditation. Am I using the right phrase? Where you really focus on people and their suffering and try to project caring and compassion. So he's tried all three, and they all work. So it's really, his results are just amazing. I've seen them. I mean, they're good statistical results. It's medical, good medical work.
It goes in line with, okay, if we're moving towards holism, that means incorporating all kinds of practices. It all depends on how far you're willing to go. But the truth is, like, you're not going to be a healthy person if you're neglecting certain aspects of both your psychology and your physiology. So yoga, these kinds of meditative practices, they all go hand in hand with what we would consider traditional Western medicine, which is actually for treating chronic conditions quite bad, very good at trauma.
Right.
So they need
each other.
Well,
that's one of Deepak's big interests is health, and opening up the health field to alternative forms of healing. That would be a whole different.
And it's so hard to do because, especially in medicine, you're talking about people's lives. So that can always be used as mud to sling at somebody, like you're endangering somebody by promoting this idea that doesn't have the stamp of approval by this whatever association that has all kinds of
association that you can't afford.
Right. So it's like there's a shaming going on in this sort of like public trial type approach to
people are voting with their feet, you know?
Exactly. So I mean, truth is, like, people are still going to it despite all that and getting results to the point where can't we codify this and make it more accessible to people and stop playing this stupid game?
That's one of the projects Deepak's working on right now. But listen, this is a different topic and I'm going to have to go here. But listen, it's been fun. I rarely get a chance to talk and have people actually listen to me, except for students, and they're like the captive audience. So if you'd like to follow some of these threads up later in another conversation, I'd be happy to do it.
Yes, I would absolutely love to. And, you know, maybe just a parting shot, anything that we should keep an eye out for or anything you'd like to announce?
Not right now, but, you know, I have really enjoyed talking with you. You're a good host and you know your stuff well. And so that's always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
All right. So thanks again, Dr. Combs. Yeah, really nice getting to know you a little bit.
Good day, and everybody that's listening, whenever this is put on the web, I hope you all have a good day too.